Americans are incredibly mobile. They're quite brave, and they're willing to just quit a job and start another thing, move to another city and begin all over again. There's an incredible culture of the possibility of reinvention.
In a recent poll of Australians, 70% claim to mistrust religious leaders. That's an astounding number of persons. Now, I don't spend a whole ton of time searching Australian polling data. I saw this because I spend a bit of my time paying attention to Michael Frost, who's an author and missiologist. Michael has spent much of the last two decades plus tilting his ear towards those who live well beyond the walls of the institutional church, because it's impossible to fulfill the imperative, the Christian imperative, to love my neighbor if I don't know my neighbor. Michael's work might be most poignantly categorized as a valiant and persistent effort to help us love those we live near. He is a professor at Moreland College in Sydney, Australia. He is the author of 12 books, including his most recent, entitled Keep Christianity Weird. It's a great title. He's also my guest on this episode of the ATSI podcast. Check it out. So, where are you actually calling me from right now? Where are you situated?
Like right this very minute, I'm sitting in my office at Moreland College.
And you've been, how long have you been at Moreland now?
20 years.
20 years this year.
Actually, I think this is the 21st year. I was interior, and there was a visiting professor from somewhere else, and one of our admin staff introduced us and said, "Oh, this is Mike." And she wasn't quite sure what to say next. She said, "He's been here forever." So that's my station here at the college. I'm just the old guy that's been here forever, you know.
You do, like, among the things you do, Moreland is, and it's not like you have an endless number of hats that you wear. You have a few things you do, authoring books and travel and teaching and leading. Is there one of those works? Is it Moreland that you feel like is like the centerpiece of your work? Is like, this is like the anchor point, or is it,
yeah.
Is that it?
No,
is
yeah,
being
no.
at the college?
Yeah, no, it's like, that's my 9 to 5, really. That's, I've been teaching here, like I said, for, 21 years now, and that's the kind of anchor. That's, you know, I've got a team. I'm in a broader kind of faculty team as well, but I've got a team in my department. I have a board. I have oversight. I get reviewed annually. And actually, I find all of those things really helpful and important.
Yeah.
I think I'm an introvert, and if I didn't have to engage in team and get on with people I don't necessarily get on with and fight and argue and have to reconcile and find common goals and collaborate, you know, it would be easy for me just not to.
All that nonsense that comes along with the whole other people problem, the problem of other people.
Right, right. And students as well. I mean, not the students are a problem, but like engaging with students, it's you know, when you've taught sort of similar stuff for a long time, it's not like they're really coming up with any great questions you've never considered before. But there is a sort of freshness about having to engage with, well, now increasingly younger compared with me people, and no, it's good. I mean, lots of the mundane everyday stuff about it annoys me. I just skipped the learning and teaching committee, which I got kind of roused on at lunchtime, but that stuff kind of bores me, but I'm thankful for it. I'm really thankful for it. But the other thing is that they're incredibly generous. So I just gallivant off around all over the place, and I've planted churches. I've run into you, of course, like in the US when I've been over there speaking. I've been adjunct teaching in different places in the US, and calling has just been incredible. Gracious about all that. So it's a great setup. It's kind of an anchor, but there's some freedom to kind of float around a bit.
And is Sydney home, like actual home? Yeah. Or is there another place in Australia that is like, you're born and raised there?
Yeah.
So as you travel and you come back to home, because you know your travel schedule, again, not incredibly like, you're not all over the world all the time, but you're gone enough that it seems like, hey, Mike travels a bit. Yeah. What does it mean for you when you're not there? What's it mean for you to be from where you are? In other words, like when you travel and you bring Sydney, Australia with you, you show up as an Australian. What does it mean for you as a like as a traveler, as a communicator, as a teacher to be Australian?
That's a good question. I go to America enough to understand it and be able to relate to it and contextualize and communicate in a way that so lots of Americans will often say to me, where do you live here in America? They always often confuse me with Alan Hirsch too, and he does America. There's an assumption, oh, you must live here now. So obviously I've kind of learned to be American enough to give the impression I understand and belong. But I don't belong and I don't fully understand, and I do bring this outsider perspective. And you know, I often find myself in America in particular talking to people and they're telling me it's got to be like this or it's always been like that. And it is helpful, I find, to be able to say, where I'm from, it's not always like that. Or no one around me where I'm from kind of assumes that. There is there's a fresh outsider perspective that I bring. But I've also worked hard to try here kind of like an insider. So I haven't thought that much about that before. It's a good question, Justin. But yeah, I think, yeah, the outsider perspective, I think, is what I bring as an Australian coming into different contexts.
On the last, I don't know if you would even call it book tour, but you were traveling on a book recently. I don't think you go and do readings per se. I mean, you go and teach and there's kind of a book that's associated with it.
Sure.
When you leave, do you have like on your runs, do you show up, are you reacting to what you're seeing, or do you tend to come with, here's something I feel like needs to be communicated? In other words, are you showing up in spaces oftentimes and feel and you're reacting, responding to what's happening in Ohio or Texas or California? Or is it like, here's some stuff that's been brewing in me and I'm going to bring it and you guys get to respond to what I'm bringing to the table?
Yeah, it's probably more the latter. Yeah, here's what I've been researching and reading and exploring and doing. And let me tell you about it and let's, you know, engage, let's interact with that. So, it's probably more the latter. I mean, you know, it's impossible to live in the world and not be conscious of what's happening in Ohio or Texas or California or whatever the case may be. So, of course, you're conscious of it. You know about it. So you can't help but in some way factor that in. But it's – no, I don't come with a blank slate. I do come, you know, with something that I – usually they've asked me to come speak about whatever it is that I've written about or even a previous book that I've written something about. So, I come with what I've got. I engage with where they're at. Americans are incredibly gracious and engaging and – activist, so it's an incredibly rich audience to talk to, because I have met so many people, so many people over the last 20, 30 years who'll say to me, I read your book, and I read some other books as well, it's not just one book does it, but I read stuff that you'd written and other people had written similarly, and I just quit my job and started doing this other thing.
Oh, wow.
And you don't meet that, you don't meet people anywhere in the world that say that. No one.
Really?
Oh, no. I mean, I've gone back. I mean, at one point I said to people in Germany who were regularly inviting me there, lots of my books are translated into German, and I go and speak at conferences and conventions over there, and I see a lot of the same kinds of people showing up to those things, and nothing ever changed, and all the questions were always the same. And I got to the point where I said, haven't I seen you people at the last, like, 6 or 8 of these things? Like, didn't you ask exactly the same questions? And there's that German thing of like, oh, wait, no, let us talk about it more. We need to reflect on this again. What about this? And let's put this into conversation with that. But it feels as though, like, does anything ever result from all of this? But with Americans, it's just sometimes it astonishes me. I mean, I remember many years ago, like when The Shaping of Things to Come first came out, right. I mean, people would say, I read your book and I quit my job and I planted a church or I started a business, or, and I would be like, holy shit, I hope what I wrote was okay. Like,
right.
People are changing their lives.
Because yes, they are. It's like the thing you want, but then it happens and you're actually stuck with, oh, wait, no, I am actually having the impact on people that I was hoping to have. This is all exactly. Rolling. In America, people change, because that's the hope, right? Is if you're communicating specifically in the world in which you're communicating, it's about practice, it's about doing, it's about whether or not you put this thing into play. It can feel, it does feel right now in the American political sphere that maybe it's that not enough is changing, or it's not changing fast enough, or maybe there's like the big step back. Most of the conversations I'm in, publicly, privately, podcast and otherwise, there is a sense of it's not the oh shit, people are actually moving the direction we want them to. It's more like, oh shit, not only are we stuck, but we seem to have fallen back 4 or 5 steps in some way, shape, or form. You don't see that. Or do you see that?
I do see that in a more kind of macro sense. I'm talking here more about individual people who, they were pastors or, clergy of one kind and just stuck in a kind of a vocational career and then read some of the stuff that I'd written, and not just me but others, but and just thought, damn it, I'm just going to go do this. I think at that level, at the micro, Americans are incredibly mobile. They're quite brave. And they're willing to just quit a job and start another thing, move to another city and begin all over again. There's an incredible culture of the possibility of reinvention. But I hear what you're saying as well about some of the kind of broader big sweeps of kind of cultural directions, and I'm not suggesting that America is making great leaps forward, but an American is always generally very conscious of what's wrong with their world and are therefore looking for solutions now, whether they're going to act on those or not. Whereas I often find, these are huge generalizations, but in lots of other contexts, there tends to be, the kind of the front foot is, well, no, I think we're okay, and we just need to defend who we are and be better at that. Americans generally think, this country's fucked up, so how are we going to fix it?
Right. Yeah.
whether they like my suggestion for how to fix it or not is entirely another matter.
Yeah. At least there's an agreement that we are in some degree of trouble. I don't know. I actually don't think it was last year, but it might have been the year before. There was a bit of a story around you being arrested. And I want to dig into this a little bit, and obviously we're going to talk about what it means for you to act politically, and what you think about. How should I say? When I say the word political, we're going to play a game here in a minute. But can you set up that moment? Like, what was going on? Like, there would be some folks who will have known that story if they've paid attention to you, but you were arrested. It became kind of a story. For you, it was like, this isn't all that big a deal, but there was a kind of a conversation around what happened. Can you set that up a little bit?
Yeah, sure. It was a big deal to get arrested. I've been arrested twice now, actually. So, I didn't enter into that lightly by any means. I mean, if I set it up by going all the way back, I grew up in a kind of a a left-leaning, you know, Labour-voting kind of trade union kind of family. So, like, at university, I was involved in demonstrations and marches and that kind of activism, probably on what people would call the sort of issues to do with the left. But, I mean, back in those days, it was, like, anti-apartheid in South Africa and nuclear disarmament and, you know, against war and the like. And so that's kind of... Yeah, that's been my posture, I suppose. Like, if there's a concern that we have about something that's going on that is destroying life and is destructive, and where vested interests are having all the say, and ordinary, common, decent people aren't being heard, then I'm always up for a march or for a demonstration or for visiting my local politician. I mean, that's just been my position. And the thing that led to kind of arrests recently for me was that we have a very draconian immigration policy. It was really terrible when yours wasn't so terrible, but the United States has kind of caught up or caught down to us in your treatment. Refugees, but we had a policy of mandatory detention. So if a refugee lands on our shores and claims asylum, they're immediately imprisoned. And wasn't seen as much of a deterrent. And so then a policy of what was called shore detention was created. And this was just vile. This was where refugee families and individuals were not only arrested, they were then repatriated to a couple of islands in the Pacific Ocean. So not on Australian soil. They actually did deals with very poor Pacific Island nations where they set up concentration camps and they imprisoned hundreds and hundreds of refugees, 90% of which were shown by the UNHCR to be genuine refugees, to have refugee status. We put their men, women, and children in these prisons on these islands. These islands of which have no industry, no educational facilities, or very rudimentary ones. And we said to them, you will never, ever, ever come to Australia. You will just either live here forever or you can go back to the to whatever dreadful situation you've escaped from. And, I mean, it was unconscionable. For a start, locking up children...
Yeah.
for the so-called crimes of their parents is just unconscionable.
Yes.
Now, it's not a crime to seek asylum. It's not a crime to claim refugee status. So their parents hadn't even committed crimes. But even if you were suggesting, well, they shouldn't have done what they did, why would we lock up their children? And then what we've discovered is that the conditions in these camps, whilst they may be sanitary and there are meals supplied and basic physical needs are met. These are essentially completely hopeless communities.
Yeah.
And if anyone wanted to conduct a despicable experiment into what happens, particularly to children and teenagers and young adults, when you take all possibility of hope, future away. Well, you could go to Nauru or Manus Island and you could observe the effects on the people who are living there. I mean, there's stories about, 8-year-olds attempting suicide. There's stories about teenagers becoming kind of catatonic, no longer eating or speaking or being able to get out of bed. I mean, literally physically shutting down because of the effects of complete and utter hopelessness. And anyway, that's the thing that tipped me over the edge. I was just outraged by this. I thought, I mean, this is I'm a taxpayer. This is my money that's funding this thing, and I'm evil. And me and a group of other ministers, Catholic nun and a Catholic priest, Anglican, Uniting Church, Baptist, Methodist, we went to the Prime Minister's office. And we conducted a prayer meeting in the waiting area to his office, praying for refugees in Nauru in particular.
Yes.
And we didn't leave when we were instructed to. We prayed and sang and worshipped all day. A medical officer actually had who had worked in the clinic at Nauru Island had smuggled medical reports out, and it revealed the depths of despair that was happening. So we were basically praying through these redacted medical reports. Mm. We had no names, but we were praying for that little eight-year-old girl who was swallowing stones in an attempt to kill herself, and this mother who'd been sexually assaulted by local people or by the camp employees. We just prayed all day, and then the police arrived at the end of the day. I mean, we're allowed to pray all day chiefly because no one wanted to arrest the elderly nun who was with us. I don't think they had any problem arresting me, quite frankly, but there was an elderly nun, and I remember the cops thinking, oh, no, like the press is outside, so this is not going to play well. So
let's just let them pray.
Let them pray as long as they can. How long can they pray for, after all? And so when we were still there at, you know, 5 p.m., they came in and arrested us and took us out. I mean, I did it again 6 months later, I think, when a few of us chained ourselves to the gates of the Prime Minister's residence for the same cause. Now, not because of those actions, but as a result of, like, a general movement within the Australian population recognising that treating children this way was despicable, enough pressure has been put on the government, and now all children and families have been removed from those concentration camps. And remarkably, the United States agreed to take most of them. New Yes. Zealand took some others. But single men, and mainly they're single Muslim men, well, they terrify good kind of suburban middle-class people, and so they are still living under these conditions. So all that to say, I guess, why did I get arrested? Not for the purpose of getting arrested. I got arrested so that people could see, look, this is not just some peripheral issue. This goes to the very heart of what we as Christians believe about the kingdom of God. I mean, we believe that if God's kingdom is unfurling inexorably, slowly but surely throughout the world and around the world and throughout history, then surely one of the evidences of that is justice and reconciliation. And for us to be either turning a blind eye or actively participating in a system that is crushing people within its gears in this way, I just didn't understand how any Christian person could not actually make a stand like that.
Would you go so far as to say that if one is to call themselves a leader, particularly among Christian people, if you're going to call yourself a religious leader, a faith leader, in specifically a Christian context, that political engagement is necessary? Is it optional at all?
No, I don't think it is optional at all. I think that where we see that that government policies are actually keeping people excluded or marginalized or poor, where we see that there is an injustice being perpetrated by government policy, I can't see how any Christian could not actively engage in that. Now, whether that goes to the point of saying, well, let's get into politics and join parties and seek to address policy change, or whether that's, no, we're simply going to engage our local members of parliament. We're going to knock on doors. We're going to stand up and vocalise a call to our government to do something different. I can't see how you could live in your country or mine and not at some stage need to have to stand up and speak in that way.
And what happened in the past, you talked about, you said the phrase the left, or like left leaning. There was kind of this left.
Yeah.
And I'm legitimately trying to get my head around this, and I don't. There are these questions of these things you say at times, where like you can pretend like you're naive in order to sound like you're above it all. I definitely have done that, but I this is not one of those moments. I can't get my head around how and why the human treatment of immigrants, care for the planet, equal treatment of women in the workplace, how these become issues that
left
are
leaning, yeah.
What the hell is that? Like how do we get there? And not even just in general, but really specifically in a, like, if this is a gospel oriented community, if this is a kingdom oriented people, like how are these left side issues? How is there any line there? I can't get my mind around it. I don't quite understand it. How has that happened? How have you seen that happen? Why is that the case?
Well, I think there's a couple of factors at play. I mean, I'd say to some degree, the left. I mean, I said before that I'd been, you know, a member of the Labour Party and a trade union member, and you know, the left tends to have championed issues of kind of equality, workers' rights. That's then led on to making representation for women's rights, women's equality, and therefore also in my country to equality for Indigenous Australians, Aboriginal peoples. Since they've cast themselves as champions of those kinds of causes, equality by and large. And to be frank, I mean, I don't want to be too simplistic about this, but there has been an anxiety among the left about the church participating to some degree on those issues as well. So there's been a bit of a kind of a, hey, you get back onto your conservative side, that's where you belong. But there has also been on the church side just a lack of imagination, an ability to just allow ourselves to be marginalised that way and to say, oh, yeah, that's right. What we're really concerned about is religious freedom, the ability to not marry same-sex couples and abortion. That's our thing. I think we need to remain steadfast in our refusal to be marginalised that way. I think that we ought to have views about a variety of issues, and I would have thought at the very least equality, or at least access, equal access for all, ought to be fundamental to our understanding of the kingdom of God. I mean, it's what Israel yearned for. Whenever you look at any of the yearnings or the desires in the exilic or post-exilic literature in the Old Testament, what is it? It's that I'll be able to build my house and plant my crops and no one will take them from us, and no child will die in infancy, and to be 100 years old but still to be young, and all these kind of fantastical dreams about, you know, equal access and opportunity. And it seems remarkable to me that we could think, well, that's not a biblical concern. And so, yeah, I think it's a lack of imagination and an ability or a propensity to be marginalized by other forces who are telling us what we should or shouldn't be interested in.
I was a game I want to play. It's not really a game. It's more like there are words that folks who have worked in their field for a long time will use in a particular way. And so this kind of this practice of lexicon that I'll actually put some guests through, not everybody, whether it be like these particular words that you will use in a way that it's not even like so incredibly distinctive from other people that it has to be explained, but because they're so common in use that it's maybe necessary or beneficial to, like, what does Michael mean when he says church? So I'm just going to throw some words at you for a few moments, and you can either, like, define them how you normally define them, or if there's a story that jumps in your mind. So there's no, like, right way to go about this. It's more like what comes out of you when I say words. And I'm going to start with one that's in this general field, feminism.
Well, to me, feminism is simply a movement of people who are committed to women having equal access and opportunity, equal to men, equal access and opportunity. I mean, it's as, to me, it's as broad as that. And in that regard, I have no problem with being considered a feminist, and I have no problem calling Christians to be feminists. Now, I acknowledge that there are second and third wave feminists out there who would embrace a much more strident and radical and leftist agenda as part of feminism. I acknowledge that. But to suggest that all feminists think that way is foolish. Those people who are anxious about feminism or being identified as one, those Christians who are anxious about that, generally are looking at the most radical or extreme expressions of feminism and claiming that that's the whole. But to me, it makes no sense. Like any great movement, like conservatism, like socialism, like any great and diverse movement, there's going to be a spectrum of beliefs on that. And so I have no problem with saying that even as a so-called conservative Christian, you can proudly call yourself a feminist without feeling as though that has to necessarily tie you as a second wave feminist.
What does it mean to pray? What is prayer?
I think prayer is a variety of things. So prayer could just be kind of the heartfelt expression of wonder and awe. A kind of a spoken expression of our absolute gratitude and joy and, as I said, wonder at that which is inexplicable and unable to be grasped, but and yet which feels so real and intimate and personal in our lives. I think prayer also is it's ritual. There's a repetitiveness to my prayer life that at one level could appear to be kind of a slavish rote style of practice, but I think that actually in the midst of that there's real beauty and joy just in the ongoing commitment to regular practice of that kind of thing. And then other times prayer is, holy shit, God help me, I'm in big trouble, or I don't know what to do. It's a plaintive call for answers or for action in your life. It's all of those kinds of things. You know, like I said before, when I was praying in the Prime Minister's office, I mean, they were heartfelt prayers for me. I mean, I prayed those prayers with tears, you know, running down my nose and from my chin. I was praying for suffering people.
Yes.
Did I think that my prayers would immediately change anything? I'm not faithful enough to believe that. But I didn't know how else to voice my brokenheartedness about that. In fact, interestingly enough, when the policeman who arrested me was leading me out of the building and out onto the street and past all the press fans and all that into the police wagon, he said to me, "Have you been praying all day?" He was quite incredulous that we could actually voice prayers from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. And I said, "We have all day." And he said, "Why? Why are you doing it?" And the first thing that came out of my mouth when I was speaking to him, you know, surrounded by all these people jostling us and everything, was because I don't know what else to do. Yeah. Like, I've been to my local member, I've written letters, I've signed petitions, I've marched in the streets, I've made banners, you know, I've done all that sort of stuff. I don't know, I feel powerless.
Yeah.
And sometimes prayer is just the voice of the powerless. And even with the most faint hope that there is an ear that hears this and responds to this in some way, I'm faithful enough to believe there is.
As a side note, we just had a conversation with a friend the other night who has gone back and forth about the effectiveness of prayer and the worthwhileness of prayer in general, even to the, you know, mostly along the lines of like, is there any point to it? Is there some sort of, is there an ear out there? What have you? And when we talked about it, the thing we came to is like, well, this might work. This might do a thing. It really might not. But the thing I know, at least for me, is it's the loving thing to do. Like, it's a thing it's at least a way to be loving. And if it's nothing but that, then well, then that's probably just fine as it is. I happen to go a little step beyond that, but in the moments when that's not as interesting or compelling to me, it's still the loving thing to do, is to, if you know, in some semblance of hope that it makes a difference, throw your voice at the sky and be like, this has to change. Can you talk about church? What is church?
Church is the society of the redeemed ones who are bound to each other through their common love of and connection to Christ, who's at the center of that community. So I've got a pretty conservative ecclesiology. You know, the church is a redeemed society. It's an alternative community. It's another way. It's a community of people who are practicing another way of being human and being a human community of society. It's a brotherhood and sisterhood. Christ is at the center. It practices peculiar and unique behaviors like rites of baptism the Lord's Supper, which are not just rituals. They are actually practices of initiation and transformation, conversion, and also of intimacy and connection and communion with God and with each other. I mean, there's something so magnificently peculiar and beautiful about church as an idea, even though we know churches in all sorts of ways have betrayed us or let us down or not lived up to all our hopes or expectations. But the concept of church is actually a quite remarkably beautiful, rich, magnificent dream of the way in which humans could operate. We could break and share a cup. We could be at one with each other. And that oneness is not just through our own kind of striving to be nice to each other, but it's through the transformation of the one who sits between us, the triune God who's very present and yet also remarkably distant, and who is making us into a different kind of people, both individually but also collectively. And that's a gorgeous idea, isn't it? I mean, yes, who wouldn't want to be part of something like that?
Last one on this list, evangelism. A lot of the conversations you're in revolve around mission, evangelism, like words that kind of get bandied about. Probably the most wounded word in there might be evangelism.
Yeah, I think you're right.
What does it mean now? For you, if you're in a conversation and someone wants you to talk to them about evangelism, they want to evangelize, what's in your mind?
Yeah, I certainly resonate with the kind of woundedness of the word. I was talking to someone the other day, I think it was a student, and they were saying, look, I'm cool, you know, with mission, and I'm cool with, you know, justice and engagement and incarnation, and it's just I don't like evangelism. And
absolutely.
It's funny you should mention that, because that's actually the only Bible word you just used. The word evangelism is actually in the scripture. It's all the way through. All those other words, as much as I like them, aren't. They derive from kind of other terms, Latin terms chiefly. But so evangelism is a biblical concept, but my definition of it is, well, my definition is this, that the mission of God's people is to alert others to the universal reign of God through Christ. So I think Christ has come to show us another way. He has shown us how to be a different kind of human, and he has instituted not only teaching but empowered us to be that alternative redeemed society. And our task is to alert people to that. And I think we alert people to that by demonstrating it, by being a community of justice and reconciliation, by committing ourselves to acts of beauty and to wholeness and to healing. All of those elements are aspects of the reign of God. But evangelism in my book is simply when we explain what those things are. That's what it is to evangelism, euangelizomai. It just means to be a bearer of good news. And whilst that term often, pretty much right across your country and mine, has been boiled down to meaning somebody who kind of hits people with a sales pitch about how to go to heaven when they die, Actually, originally, whenever Paul said, "This is my gospel, this is my good news," it was always rooted in, "This is my friend and King Jesus, and this is the remarkable world that he's invited me to be part of." So for me, evangelism is the spoken part of that way in which we alert people to the reign of King Jesus.
A decent amount of time, and I swear to God, this is not a critique. You spend a decent amount of time online. You're on Facebook a bit. You spend some time on Twitter. Do you enjoy online interactions? Okay, layers of questions. Do you enjoy online interactions? And do you see fruit born in online interactions? Is that a healthy place? Is that a fruitful place? Is that a beneficial place to spend time with other people?
Well, there are plenty of people who've gotten terribly, terribly pissed off with me on social media. I don't find that a pleasant thing, and they clearly don't either. But honestly, I don't think a week goes by. It would have to be weekly. I'm wondering if it's more often than that, but let's just say weekly. Somebody will contact me out of the blue and say, say things like, "I'm only barely just hanging on to faith in God, and one of the few things that kind of keeps me in there is like reading your Facebook posts, or you know, reading the links to articles that you share, or watching the clips that you share, or reading your blog, or." Don't stop, please. Like, I can't find anybody who's quite like that, and it still gives me hope that I can still be called a follower of Jesus. I mean, it's incredibly touching when I get stuff like that. But then there's other people who are just like, "Hey, I felt incredibly despondent or lost or broken or uncertain about this topic or this issue or this question in my life. And I want to let you know that thing you shared from Justin McRoberts, or you know that thing that you wrote, or you know this thing," like that just turned it all around for me. Mm. And so they're not saying, "Hey, like I read you every day and I think you're great." They're just saying that one thing you shared, that was exactly what I needed. So do I enjoy it? I enjoy that. I enjoy knowing that there are people who are who feel a sense of connection and community with someone like me, whom they might never have actually met. Mm-hmm. I feel connected to you, Justin. Like, I know we've met before, like a few times, but, I follow you on social media. I love the prayers that you write and some of the stuff that you share. I feel sort of a connection to you. I think you're a kind of kindred spirit. And most of that has been because of our online connections to each other. So 100%. I do think that there is something incredibly rich and beautiful about it. I used to throw more grenades and try and start kind of more discussions that turned into fights than I probably do these days. I'm still going to put stuff out there that's, I know I won't be agreed to by lots of people, but I'm not trying to be belligerent. I'm just trying to provoke some thought. And every so often, it's not weekly by any means, but every so often, someone will say, "You know, I would never have called myself a feminist, but I started reading some of the stuff that you shared, and you know something? I just thought, I only said that before because I'd never really thought about it, and I think I agree with you now." Now, I'm not turning like hardcore NRA members over to the idea of gun control, but I'm not switching hardcore people who are committed to an alternate view to me. I don't think that happens hardly ever. But there are people who tend to be, they have passive belief in things that they've never really questioned or explored. And I've provoked them to read and to explore and to look at it, and they've ended up changing their mind. So I do think it's a fruitful kind of a platform to get people thinking and engaging and questioning and connecting. Yeah.
Healthy mentally, emotionally, physically. You're engaged in a lot of in conversations with people, life transformation. Like, how do you take care of yourself? What's it look like for you to make sure you're okay?
I have a spiritual director. I, as I said before, we were talking about Maul in college. I report to someone at the college, a line manager who holds me to account in terms of like my professional conduct. I'm not the greatest or most conscientious exerciser, but I try to seek to be active. I mean, I live in Sydney on a harbour near a beach. So I paddle, a kayak, I jog a little bit. I mean, I'm no great example of what it's like to be kind of super healthy or anything, but yeah, you just build rhythms into your life. I have rhythms of prayer in my life, rhythms of accountability, and rhythms of being active and engaged. But the other thing too is I have rhythms of socializing and hospitality and drinking great wine and good food. So, I don't know that I've got a kind of an answer for, you know, this is what it looks like. I just seek to be as generative as I can. And actually, the more I think about it, my wife Kaz is an incredibly generative person. She's physically active, she's deeply spiritual, and she's an incredible people person. And I think she, like, we've been married for 35 years. I think she had an enormous influence on drawing me into those rhythms as well. I was just saying something to someone the other day. It was very heartfelt, and I meant it really sincerely. It was a kind of personal life advice, and they found it incredibly helpful. And as I was saying it, I was thinking, I got all this stuff from Kaz. It's like Kaz speaking right now.
Yeah. Those are good moments. Yeah. Years ago, had a great interaction with someone who, when I started playing music, literally put me on stage in front of a bunch of music executives and said, "This is Justin McRoberts. He's not very good right now." This is how I was introduced on stage. "This is Justin McRoberts. He's not very good right now, but I'm hoping that 15 or 20 years from now, he'll still be making music and it'll be good." And that's the investment I'm making, which, like, it changed everything for me. Was like, oh, so my successes didn't matter, and they were like, that's fine. My failures didn't matter. I had this like 15 or 20 year vision. Like, oh, I can buy into that. I want to kind of go backwards and forwards. We'll start with backwards. 20 years ago to now, is there something you know now about yourself, about your world, that is like definitive, like a definitive change that you can look at now? I'm like, I know this now, and not even like I wish I would have known it then, but here's a thing that like I know now that I did not know then that is like actually definitive of who I am as a person.
Well, for sure. But can I just jump back into your story? How old was the? Was it a guy who was saying he's Justin McRoberts? He's not good yet, but he will be. Like, that was a guy saying that?
Yeah. So he was a guy named Frank Tate.
And how old was he then?
He was, Sam, I was 24. So Frank was probably 33.
Oh, okay. So a little bit older, yeah. I was really kind of touched by the story because I feel like I'm now in my late 50s and I no longer have the kind of energy, not like I'm worn out, I don't have the energy. There's just no longer that same energy to bust down doors and make things happen and launch things and start things. But I have an incredible, I feel really powerful in my ability to come alongside a 20-something-year-old or 30-something-year-old and say, yeah, he's not great now, but he's going to do great things, and I'm going to spend some of whatever kind of social or ecclesial capital I've got here to kind of back this person. And I'm really feeling like strongly drawn into the role of elderhood, you know. I mean, of actually being the kind of the old chief or warrior that's fought lots of battles and got plenty of scars and who's given a great deal of kudos by the tribe. And but I'm not going to use it for my own thing, whatever that is. I want to actually mentor or coach or open doors for women and men who are wanting to launch something, begin something. So the whole idea of saying, hey, this person isn't great now, but they're going to be, I just feel like I more and more that's the kind of role that I have, and I'm really enjoying. I'd love to do it more. Like, you know, if you're a 20-year-old and you want to get on stage, metaphorically, since I'm not a stage person, I want to make use of that in a sense. That's so good. I mean, what do I know now? I guess I know that, you know, there are different ages and stages of your life. There are different energies that propel you. Yeah. And, you know, when you are younger, you are a door breaker. You want to launch and start and begin, and you feel like no one else is doing this and no one else has thought this and I need to do it. And at my age now, you think, no, none of that's true. Plenty of other people have tried that or done that, but I'm going to let you still believe that, and I'm going to back you on this. Yeah. Like, how can I help? How can I support you? And I guess if I could go back to younger me, I'd say, can you try and find somebody in their 50s like that, mm-hmm. or someone in their 60s like that? The Kiwis, the Maori people in New Zealand refer to this as mana. They say that certain warriors have mana because of the many, many wars that they've fought, or the victories that they've led. And old men, they transfer their mana onto, in that culture, it's other men. But I don't want to be so patriarchal about it. If I can support, and I do support lots of young women wanting to move into leadership or preaching or church planting or, you know, whatever it might be. So, I guess I wish 20 years ago I had have been better prepared to think about how to prepare for being a kind of an elder.
So then fast forwarding, or kind of looking forward, if you are 100 times more successful, successful is not exactly the word, let's say effective, if the world is shaped, if you can shape the world around you, specifically the church, but the world around you, if you become like incredibly influential, what does the world look like if you have your druthers? You get to shape things, the church, culture. What are some things that, like, if maybe there are like three or four, again, distinctives that if Michael Frost can get a hold of the world and the church and have his way, what's it look like when, if you leave the world in a better place, people can trace back to you? What are the things that are like, that's what I want to do with the world if I can?
Well, if I could have some magical thinking on this for a while, I would say somehow to kind of break the nexus between the kind of left, right, liberal, progressive kind of divide, which I think is just destroying our culture and our church. I mean, it's just monstrous. Yes. The inability for people to even hear each other with alternative views on certain social issues and political issues it's devastating. It's devastating our churches. It's devastating our culture. It's destroying our politics. It's kind of ruining our neighborhoods. no one is friends with anyone from the other side of the political spectrum anymore. Mm. We don't know how to talk to each other. I mean, back in the day, my dad, like I said, he was a trade unionist. He was like a Labour voter. But we had friends, you know, we knew were Conservative voters. And often the way they would interact, they'd argue and disagree with each other, but then also kind of joke and laugh at each other, you know, about the foibles of the left or the right. There was a kind of a sense in which there was a camaraderie where, well, we all know you're on the left or you're on the right, mm-hmm. but we can still talk. We can still work together. There are still common concerns that we have. Whereas right now, I just see that more and more extreme. And there's no indication that there's any likelihood that it's going to do anything other than kind of tear the very fabric of society, and it's tearing our churches apart as well. I mean, you mentioned this before. You just have to say, like, can we get some immigration reform in this country? And a whole bunch of people just say that you're a lefty or a socialist, and that's boom, finished. The conversation ends. And that's incredibly, incredibly corrosive in society. And of course, the other one is race. You know, again, there's been no real indication that the church has moved in any sense toward greater diversity or integration. You know, there's some steps that's been taken, but with the death of the suburbs and the closing down of shopping malls, suburban culture, which is so shaped white evangelical charismatic churches, is disappearing, and the church that it created will, I think, continue to disappear. And as white evangelicals and charismatics are moving into neighborhoods and into cities, there's this obsession with them planting their own white churches when there have been Hispanic or black churches serving in those neighborhoods, you know, for 100 years or more. That's how completely non-negotiable the kind of the racial divide is. I mean, everyone's certainly really kind of polite about it all, but there isn't actually very much movement in that regard. So if I could wave a wand and say, what would I like to see happen? I'd like to see a renewed desire for us to connect across the left and right divide, and for us to work on developing genuinely multi-ethnic churches right across our countries.
Matt, thank you for your time.
Not at all. It's good to talk.
And thank you for joining us for this episode of the At Sea Podcast. If you'd like to pay attention to Mike Frost the way I do, you might want to find him on Facebook. Some lively conversation on both of his pages, personal and professional. Or you can visit MikeFrost.net, MikeFrost.net, where he is described actually as an author, a speaker, a missiologist, and an agitator. So if you were agitated at any point in this conversation, that's part of his job, and he's done it. If you'd like to support the efforts of this podcast, you can visit me at patreon.com/Justin McRoberts. We would love to have you on the team. Until next time.